Hello and welcome to Back Chat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up there in Preston. And Nikki Radio in Hertfordshire. And to our listeners in Swindon. Hello, Swindon FM.
Our second Christmas show is a chance to hear again some of the features that we played during the past year, which you may have missed. So we're going to start with our very first show and our very first feature. So here's Lily Marion. Lily is talking to Laurie Jones.
Our guest in the studio this week is Laurie Jones, and he's here to talk about the smallpox outbreak in Wales when he was a small boy growing up in the valleys. Hello, Laurie.
Hello.
How old were you in the first outbreak?
Well, I was 12. I'd just gone to grammar school, and it was 1962, winter of 1962, which a lot of people may remember. It was a very, very hard, cold, bleak winter.
And how did the epidemic start?
Well, we first heard about it through news reports on the BBC. It came very, very unexpected, round about sort of, I think it would have been early February when we first became fully aware of it.
What was the cause of the epidemic?
Well, by all accounts, it's a Pakistani, actually. He came over from Karachi, and there'd been a major outbreak in Karachi. Flown into London, then took a taxi to Birmingham, and then eventually ended up in a restaurant in Cardiff, where he stayed for a few days. He became very, very ill, and they called a local doctor, who had never seen anything like it before. His body was covered in sores and pustules, and he had a very, very high temperature. So the doctor took advice and brought in another doctor who had experience with tropical diseases, and he thought it may be smallpox.
What sort of precautions did the town take?
Well, fortunately, there was no outbreak in Cardiff at all. So he was first moved to an isolation hospital on the outskirts of Cardiff. They took advice from the health authority, who decided to move Mr. Miat to an isolation hospital that was on the top of the mountain just overlooking the Rhondda. It was called Penrith Hospital, an isolation hospital, and that's where he went.
So when you were growing up, were you subject to any people that you knew with the disease?
Yes, actually. The outbreak itself lasted for about 2.5 months in total. So the first we got to know about it was that there was a smallpox victim in the isolation hospital. But after a week or so, it actually got out into the community. And there was a lady, I believe her name was Margaret Mansfield, and she was heavily pregnant, and she'd just given birth to a baby, a stillborn baby. And the gynecologist who attended the post-mortem was from a nearby hospital called Church Village, or East Glamorgan Hospital, as it's now known. His name was Dr. Robert Hodkinson, very, very well known. And within a few days, he'd been stricken down with the disease as well. And sadly, he died about 12 days later, in fact, from the first initial stages.
What sort of precautions did you and your family take?
Well, it wasn't just me and the family, it was the whole community. We were absolutely terrified, because once we realised that it got out into the community, the whole of the two valleys, actually, because the Rhondda has, you know, Rhondda Vach and Rhondda Vau, were panic-stricken. The first thing was we were all desperately trying to get inoculated. There were very, very limited supplies. Now, in those days, the population of the two Rhonddas would have been about 95,000. You could imagine, you know, everybody was clamouring, fighting to get inoculated. They did reasonably well, but there were no supplies in the country. So, amazingly, the bulk of the supplies came from Argentina.
Oh, really? Mm. How long did the epidemic last?
Well, in total, I think it was all over 3, maybe 4 months in total. But during the epidemic, of course, there were little outbreaks in other areas as well, not just the Rhondda. There was a hospital for dementia sufferers, I suppose, called Glanfried, and there was a major outbreak there, and a number of old ladies died in a very, very short period of time, and that was very, very worrying. But the main problem, of course, was how we coped with it in the valleys itself. You know, I used to go to the local cafe that was closed, The youth club was closed, the pubs were closed, the clubs were closed, the cinemas were totally empty, and you'd see nobody in the streets at all. Now, my family, we actually ran a grocery business and a dairy business, so we used to deliver milk to the community, and we were treated like lepers. People wouldn't open the doors to us, they certainly wouldn't pay their milk bills or their groceries. And our grocery shop was totally deserted. And normally it was in the centre of the community. But everybody was ringing their orders for their groceries and we were having to deliver them. And literally we were doing this. Oh, gosh, we started work at 4 o'clock in the morning and we'd finish about 10:30 at night. And we were doing this every day. It was totally exhausted. And at the same time, nobody would speak to us.
What was the lasting effect on the epidemic?
Number of people have survived. The total number of cases in Rwanda, I believe, was about 47. 17 or 18 died. So that was quite a lot. But of the survivors, they were very, very heavily pockmarked. If you can imagine the disease itself, it was particularly aggressive, and the body would be covered, starting at the head, and then the whole of the upper body would be covered in pustules. Another problem was everyone who had it, they would lose their hair, and also blindness was another sort of major concern. And of course, those that did survive had to sort of live in the community, and everyone was aware, you know, because of the way they looked, their appearance, you know, that they had actually sort of suffered. But of course, those families that had survived, you know, everything that they owned had to be burned. You know, it started off with the police van that brought Mr. Shear into the isolation hospital. That was burnt. We saw that on the news, and that was pretty dramatic. And then Mrs. Mansfield, her furniture, her clothes, everything was burnt. And her sister also caught the disease, and she died. So the same thing happened to her as well. So there was a lasting legacy, actually.
You mentioned the police. What take did the authorities... What did they do to keep the population calm?
Well, not that much, to be perfectly honest. I can remember right at the peak of the outbreak, it was quite frightening because they were using health centres, clinics, pubs, schools, anywhere they could probably, you know, possibly get hold of to carry out the inoculation. Now, the injections themselves, they weren't like an ordinary injection. The skin had to be torn, and it had a sort of a strange needle, which I seem to remember, with two hooks on it. And they would tear the skin, and then they would dab the cowpox, which it was, onto the skin. And after a few days, it would turn very, very bright red. That showed that it was actually having an effect. And then we all had scabs. I remember at school, you know, all the kids were comparing scabs.
Oh, really?
And they all dropped off at the same time. So it's pretty gruesome, but I remember those memories.
So is it 50 years this year?
50 years, yes. I was watching a series of dramas the BBC Wales produced called The Indian Doctor. It was written by Tom Ware, who used to work at the BBC in Bristol. It was a fictitious account of smallpox, but it did actually sort of bring the whole thing home, that I'd actually lived through possibly one of the most scary plagues, basically, diseases that's actually happened in the last century.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's great that you're here today to talk about it. Thank you very much, Laurie.
Okay, you're welcome.
That was Lily Marion talking to Laurie Jones about the smallpox epidemic that broke out 50 years ago in Wales. In our second programme, John Peters Coleman presented the show, and he's going to introduce the feature about partition in India.
Time to turn back time to 1947 and a bit of history about India for our next feature. Back in 1947, India was rocked by civil unrest as the country was divided into three areas, Bangladesh, Pakistan and India, which separated warring religious factions. Between 10 and 12 million people crossed the border between Pakistan and India on the 14th and 15th of August 1947. Independence ended British rule over the continent. Gandhi led India to peace and inspired movements for non-violence, civil rights and freedoms across the world. He was assassinated for his troubles on the 30th of January 1948 by a Hindu nationalist who thought Gandhi was too sympathetic to India's Muslims. The first in music by Ravi Shankar, followed by a speech by Gandhi himself. Oh,
Perceive that whilst everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is underlying all that change a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates. That informing power of spirit is God, and since nothing else that I see merely through the senses can or will persist, he alone is. And is this power benevolent or malevolent? I see it as purely benevolent, for I can see that in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. Hence I gather that God is life, truth, light. He is love. He is the supreme good. But he is no God who merely satisfies the intellect, if he ever does. God, to be God, must rule the heart and transform it. He must express himself in every smallest act of his votary. This can only be done through a definite realization, more real than the five senses can ever produce. Sense perceptions can be, and often are, false and deceptive, however real they may appear to us. Where there is realization outside the senses, it is infallible. It is proved not by extraneous evidence, but in the transformed conduct and character of those who have felt the real presence of God within. Such testimony is to be found in the experiences of an unbroken line of prophets and sages in all countries and climes. To reject this evidence is to deny oneself. This realization is preceded by an immovable faith. He who would, in his own person, test the fact of God's presence can do so by a living faith. And since faith itself cannot be proved by extraneous evidence, the safest course is to believe in the moral government of the world, and therefore in the supremacy of the moral law, the law of truth and love. Exercise of faith will be the safest where there is a clear determination summarily to reject all that is contrary to truth and love. I confess that I have no argument to convince through reason. Faith transcends reason. All as I can advise is not to attempt the impossible.
Pat Hart, whose parents were Anglo-Indians, came to Britain shortly after partition in India. He tells us of the problems faced by many Anglo-Indians as they struggled to adapt to a British society.
I'm here with Pat Hart from VCFMs. Pat, can you tell me something about your background?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was something that I was quite confused about as I was growing up in England, but both of my parents are Anglo-Indian, and they came to the UK during the time of partition, which was in the late 40s, I believe, at the time. Anyone who's seen the Gandhi film would probably get a little bit of a flavour for it. Yeah, it was a confusing time for me because I was by religion a Catholic. Both my parents loved England and the Queen and knew so much about England. I used to wonder why I was so different from some of the people I would met at church or whatever that maybe were from India or then Pakistan, who were Hindus and Muslims. I wouldn't understand that. Until I began to speak to a lot of my older relatives, my aunties and uncles, who explained to me about the time of partition. And when you were an Anglo-Indian, you were actually, Hindus and the Muslims were fighting each other. Gandhi was saying, stop the fighting. But if you were an Anglo-Indian, you were almost an enemy of everybody there.
The word partition, can you give us a bit of background as to what was happening in India at that time?
Sure. I mean, the partition was when the British were in occupying India, and part of the condition for the British to withdraw from India was to actually partition the country into two, actually probably three bits. The two big bits were India and Pakistan. And the way that it worked was that the majority of Muslims would then move over to Pakistan and the Sikhs and Hindus would stay within India. But it brought its problems, and at the time of partition, my grandfather on my mother's side was in charge of a number of railway stations, which the Anglo-Indians were.
An Anglo-Indian is what, Pat?
Well, an Anglo-Indian is somebody, I mean, as it says, it often says English stroke Indian, but that wasn't always the exact case, because sometimes there was the Portuguese side as well.
We're talking mixed race here.
That's right, but something more, you know, I've only recently found out or realised is that a lot of the English army people were encouraged to marry a higher class Indian woman because there was this shortage, and hence where Anglo-Indians came.
We've got the caste system coming into the reckoning here as well, haven't we?
Well, yeah, in that respect, still exists today in India. So we're in this situation where the Anglo-Indians were literally the servants, I guess, the direct servants of the English. So they had to flee during the time of partition. And there are stories that my aunties and uncles have told me about my granddad being in charge of the station at Calcutta, the railway station, and actually seeing trains coming in from across the border where there were massacres taking place.
You mentioned something about railway massacres. What was that all about?
Well, that's right, and it's one of those horrible situations that often it's kind of relayed by uncles and aunties, but whilst the country was in the middle of being partitioned and in the early parts of partition, there was still fighting. There wasn't just fighting against some of the English as well, but they were fighting across the borders and between a lot of the Sikhs, Muslims and Hindus. And so what would happen is, whilst this country was being partitioned, people were moving, literally being pushed across borders to say, look, you're a Muslim, this is where you should be living. And as they were there, whether it was particular armies or individual groups of people, were actually massacring people because of their religion. In other words, they weren't allowed to get across the border. And so often, the people that ran these rail stations would end up having to go and inspect the trains, the carriages, as they pulled into those stations to see such horrible scenes of people being murdered and just left dead.
Listeners might have watched The Jewel in the Crown, because there's a particular incident where a railway carriage with a Muslim in it has had the crescent moon chalked on it, and it stopped later on, and someone's taken out and shot.
Absolutely right. So there was that complication, and of course Anglo-Indians predominantly were Christians, and more often than not were Catholics because of that strong kind of Portuguese background as well. So that was much of the recollection, and Anglo-Indians in many respects were almost like a lost race, because they came over not only to the UK but Australia and Holland, and were dispersed right across the world with the help of the British to go and live in these countries. My family came here to the UK. You know, my father was a teacher, couldn't get a job here. And so we grew up with this very old-fashioned Victorian upbringing, if you like, with well-spoken and well-educated parents. But to look at us, when we looked in the mirror, we were a different colour, you know, to our English friends. And very often, our values were more similar to those of middle-class young people going to private schools than they were of our working-class friends, where we mixed. Because from an economic point of view, we were poor. So we went to the local comprehensive school, lived in the council houses, as our mates did. But from a value point of view, the values of our parents were very similar to those of middle-class kids. Go to university, be a doctor, be a lawyer, etc., etc. So, and I think in lots of ways, it's a story that probably still hasn't yet been fully told about the plight of Anglo-Indians, simply because it's from that 40s, and so many of those Anglo-Indians have now passed away, unfortunately.
When you came to this country, what sort of prejudices did your parents encounter? Being Anglo-Indians, you touched upon it.
Sure. I've been lucky enough to have a kind of reasonable music career as well, where we sold quite a lot of kind of singles and albums. In one of the tracks is a line that says that we were from a working family and we struggled real hard, and when we came to this country, we didn't even have a backyard. And what that meant was that we were stuck in this one-room flat. My father was a teacher, a very well-educated teacher, would go for jobs. He was well-spoken. As soon as people saw his face, he was suddenly told that the vacancy had been filled. And he ended up having to take things like just night watchman jobs and being a petrol pump attendant, which he did because there were a family of four of us.
And what part of the country were
we came initially to Nottingham, but when we first arrived in the UK, both my parents went to work for the British Embassy in Kuwait, funnily enough, where two of my three brothers were born. So we worked in Kuwait. Ironically, my father was dishing out visas to the Saudi Arabians. Think how much money he could have made if he was dishonest, but he wasn't. He's a very honest man. So we came back, lived in Nottingham until I was 13, when we had a few problems in school as youngsters. We were a little bit naughty, so my dad moved over to Bristol, which we completely hated the concept of moving to this place we'd never heard of. But now I call Bristol home. If I carried on living in the UK, I wouldn't live anywhere else but Bristol because it's so diverse.
So we're talking like early 60s. Paul Stevens has written a book about this. It's the boycott by the bus companies of employing Indians and Anglo-Indians at the time. But they couldn't happen nowadays because of the Race Relations Act. Your parents, did they ever encounter the sort of racism that was prevalent in the early 60s?
Definitely, but both my parents did. But I think very similar to our African Caribbean cousins that came over in Windrush those times as well, is that our parents almost suffered silently. It was only the next generation who wanted to be more vociferous, I guess because of the anger about what their parents had been through. For me, the only things that would ever get me into trouble in school, the cause of fight, were when people would say something nasty about my parents. That was the only thing. And I think that so many first generation Asian or African Caribbean kids, they feel so enthusiastic because they did, to a large extent, suffer in silence. They went to work, they did the jobs, they were openly racially abused, often they couldn't even get the jobs that they were qualified for, but they felt, look, I'm going to carry on, almost like Gandhi, turning the other cheek forever and ever. I'm going to carry on, I'm going to do my job, and I'm going to make people love and respect me, which we wonder why there is so many mental health issues amongst the older African Caribbean community and some of the Asian community, because they had to put up with so much of that for the safety and the well-being of their own children. So I can't do anything but applaud. Sadly, my mum passed away a couple of years ago, but my dad's 82, he's still with me, and I can do absolutely nothing but applaud the sacrifice that they made for me, and certainly the sacrifices that so many parents of that generation made for their children too.
You heard Alex Milner interviewing Pat Hart about partition in India. From India to Tirana in Albania, we meet Warren Anderson, an American working for a TV station. He's talking about the current political scene in the country. Albania was, of course, closed to the outside world during the dictatorship of Enver Hoxha. The only entertainment allowed, strangely enough, were the films of Norman Wisdom.
Hello, Warren Anderson, St. Paul, Minnesota.
And you work for the television channel in Tirana, Albania.
Yes, that's one of my jobs, Ora News. I do the English language news at 6 o'clock.
Can you tell us what you think about the politics over here?
Well, if you're familiar with the old Marx Brothers duck soup and the nation of Fredonia, you have the politicians here in Albania and the politics of Albania and the frustrations of Albania. A place that doesn't work, a place that with crazy leaders that, you know, just hate each other. Is he really a socialist or does he just hate the other guy? You have with the corruption. So the politics here is pretty bad. It's not a good thing. It's not a positive thing. It's something, in fact, to be very worried about. If they don't change in the next 5-10 years, they've got problems. Berisha wants to be in power. He wants to win the re-elections. Rama is no better. Ilir Meta is, God, no better. Maybe the new political party with the president, Bamir Topi, and some of the conservatives, some of the Democrat Party, Berisha's group, leaving Berisha and joining Topi, that might be a good thing.
You've been here since 2008. What changes have you seen since that time?
There's changes in services, less electrical cuts, less water cuts, or almost none. You've seen buildings going up. You've seen new businesses starting, unfortunately, mainly gambling and coffee houses. That's a big thing, coffee houses. people are industrious. Unfortunately, there's not any industry, but people are industrious, and they're trying to do business. They're trying to open businesses to make more money. Fortunately, the people haven't changed in the sense that they're still very nice. They're great, very welcoming and friendly to foreigners, love Americans. They are very honest shopkeepers, and that will come racing after you because you paid 50 cents too much. So that is a good thing. The worry is the politics and the politicians, you know, the future of Albania. If they don't change in the next 5 or 10 years, I think that you're going to see an Albania that goes the way of Greece or worse. I really think 10 years, 15 years, you could see a Balkans in flames again. We have averted our eyes. We think everything's taken care of here, and it is not. You have former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which is a state in somebody's dreams. It's not a real country. There's no such thing as Macedonians unless they're Greek. They're either Slavs or they're Albanians, and they're Christian and they're Muslim, and they just don't get along together. They don't. They want to kill each other. They say horrible things about each other. There's no unity. They're not a nation. They're not a nation united in people. They don't have a common history. You have difficulties in Kosovo with the Serb minority and the Albanians. In fact, I've heard Albanians here describe the Kosovo Albanians as a little bit more radical, a little bit crazier. They should be able to get along with the Serbs. They should be able to get along with the Christians, the way it's done here in Albania, the way the history of Albania is. And that's one of the great things about Albania, and perhaps something not known by most people, is that whereas in the rest of the Balkans you have people killing each other because they're Muslim or they're Christian or they're Orthodox or, you know, what type of Christian, what type of Muslim, and they kill each other. Here in Albania, as far as I can tell, that never happened. In fact, quite the opposite. They celebrate each other's religion. They join together to celebrate each other's holidays. When there's a holiday, everybody gets out. Just because it's Christmas, not just the Christians leave the school, everybody has school off. Same with the end of Ramadan. People are, the word is besa, and it showed itself in World War II. The one nation on earth, the one nation certainly in Europe, all of Europe, where if you were Jewish and you made it here, you were safe. England, of course, but how did you get to England? Here, you were safe. And it wasn't a government that said, we'll protect you. It wasn't a government in exile that said, protect these people. It wasn't a king that said, protect these people. It wasn't the partisan leader, Hoxha, or any of the other partisans saying, protect these people. It was the individual Albanian family or leader of a family that said, here are people in need. Here are people that are being hunted down to be killed. And we're not, it's just not right. We're not going to let that happen. Whole Jewish families would be safe in an Albanian family's house. It's the only nation in at least continental Europe where there were more Jews at the end of the war than there were at the beginning of the war. And that just says something about the people. And that's why I think Albania is special and why these next 5-10 years are crucial, because I don't believe that it's good for Albania to be part of the European Union. I don't think that would be a good thing. All you have to do is look at Greece. I don't think the European Union really wants Albania or the Balkans in. Now, why would they if, you know, look what happened, again, the Greeks, the Bulgarians, the Romanians, the fun they're having with those two countries. So somehow Albania has to make its mark on its own. It has to, there needs to be an Albanian spring. Young people, more open-minded politicians, and I've met a couple of them that understand about the corruption and things like that, need to get the ability to have power and to get in charge. The problem is you have a constitution that's so whacked out and weird, and that it allows this virtual dictatorship of whoever's the prime minister. You know, who's going to be president? How are they going to choose who's going to be president? How are they going to agree on that person? According to the EU, it has to be a consensus choice. Well, just because they are what they are. If one said Jesus Christ and the other said Muhammad, they both say no to both of them. Mother Teresa couldn't be picked. If one supported it, the other would say she's the devil reincarnated. It doesn't matter. So somehow there has to be an awakening here. There has to be an understanding that they have something special here. This is a great country. They have something special. They have hydroelectric power. They have the solar power. They have wind energy. They have geothermal. They have all the water they need. They have all the land they need to produce food organically. They have everything that Europe, they have the people that are hungry for jobs and that had industry before until the communism ended, and then people destroyed all the industries. they could be a small little powerhouse in the Balkans, and they could provide the rest of the Balkan nations, especially Kosovo, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, Serbia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, vision of what to, if we're like this, then we can also gain these benefits and make the Balkans peaceful rather than the possible powder keg that I think it will become in 10, 15 years if there's not changes.
From Albania to the Arnolfini here in Bristol, to the TV show The Apprentice, we meet one of the contestants to tell us about working with Sir Alan Sugar.
Gabrielle Aymar, and I was on this year's Beauty One's Apprentice. So tell us all about it. Really crazy, insane and intense process, but I'm glad I did it. Didn't expect to get onto the show. I wasn't planned to go onto the show. Somehow found myself on there and, every week was trying to get through to the next task, and it was, daunting and nerve-wracking and tiring, but, somehow I got 10 weeks out of 12, which I'm really happy with, actually.
What was the worst task that you had to do?
Worst task? Quite a few, actually. Now, I think, I don't know if there was any really bad tasks, because I kind of threw myself into every single one. Yeah, maybe like a food task, I think, where I didn't really know much about food production. Basically, anything that I've never done or associated myself with before, I think, was quite nerve-wracking. But tasks like, and there was an art task in there, which, we had set up our own art gallery, and I was project manager, and we won, and I loved every single second of that task. And there was another task where we had to upcycle absolute rubbish, sell it in the shop, pieces of junk, really, which we made into... or attempted to make into, pretty pieces of furniture. Yeah, that was a really good task for me as well, because I was top seller in that one as well. And, generally, had a really great experience, I think, on that show. So, glad I did it.
What was Alan Sugar like to meet? Was he quite intimidating?
Yeah, Lord Sugar is exactly as you see him on TV. He can be your lovely, fun granddad, and some days he has those days, but I'd say 90% of the time he's stern, he doesn't take any rubbish, he's just to the point, and it can be quite intimidating. But luckily, I think, because I was in the boardroom, final three from the first week, so I got to know him quite quickly, so there wasn't any time to think about, oh God, what am I going to say to him when I do have a one-to-one with him, but now I went straight in it, and he's a nice guy actually, but very, very intimidating, and it can be quite scary at times.
Did you find you had more respect for him after the show?
In all honesty, no. I don't think I did have more respect for him. Maybe slightly lost a little bit. I think it doesn't take much to shake somebody's hand after you've been dealing with them for, even if it's a day or a few weeks or even a couple of months. It doesn't take much to say, nice to meet you, or well done, or anything like that. Or, or just a shake of the hand, good luck. And unfortunately, he wasn't like that at all. And if you did attempt to go and shake his hand, he kind of dismissed you. So it's definitely for him, I realised, more of a publicity, fame thing, The Apprentice, rather than a business venture for him. So slightly lost respect for him. But at the same time, he's done very well and he's got to where he's got to with hard work. So I can't criticise him too much.
How hard was it to work with other competitive people?
Being the only architect on the show and being quite creative, I found working with those that are very sales-based or very, or just basically completely different professions, I found that they took to me more of, I think they thought because I was in a more creative industry, I could be trodden on a bit more and, they can take advantage a bit more. Obviously, once I got to the boardroom, they were like, God, what happened to this person? Put me in the corner and I'll fight my way out. It's a really good experience, but sometimes it was difficult and other times not so much. But again, I think, my personality anyways seems to deal with them quite well, so it was not that bad.
So how useful has it been, that experience, to your work since?
I think, to be honest, within the architecture world, it's been brilliant for me. I've got a bit more publicity for myself and my company, which is always useful, and that's given me opportunities to fight for jobs and bid for jobs that I would never have the confidence to do so, probably previous. And, having a name out there before I even reach a meeting is generally a good thing because people know what to expect and they already want to deal with you. So, so far, so good.
What's it like when people come up to you in the street or recognise you on the bus? because you're quite a celebrity now.
Yeah, no, obviously as the show was on, it was very surreal because after filming, you're not allowed to tell anyone that you've been on the show. And, you know, the first day it came out in the Radio Times and announced all the candidates for the following year, it was amazing. I felt like I was prompted from zero to hero kind of situation. So it was great. And, yeah, it was... But people do come up to see... You know, I'm one of those candidates that gets hugged a lot. Some of the other candidates don't so much, but I'm one of those ones for some reason. Maybe it's my personality, I don't know what, but they tend to hug me as well as, you know, just say hi, which is nice. It's lovely. Some days you need a hug. So, no, it's a good experience. And again, I went on, I went to a few like film premieres as well, which is great. I actually went on the red carpet and it was amazing. Whether I'll be able to do that again, don't know. But for that short period of time, my 15 minutes of fame, I think I enjoyed it very well and I made the most of it.
Danan McAleer, another of Backchat's presenters, now introduces an interview with Mark Vaughan. Here talking about his late mother, one of the Newlyn artists, Pip Benveniste.
Pip Benveniste was a painter, printmaker, photographer, rug designer and filmmaker. One of the 16mm films she shot in the 1960s, Eventual, explored the anarchic arts world of the time, from student unrest in Hornsey, North London, to the Paris riots of 1968. The film was shown at Tate Britain in its 2004 exhibition, Art in the 60s, This Was Tomorrow. But like many of the female artists of her generation, she did not have a career, she had a context. Recently, her son, Mark Vaughan, launched a project of rugs designed by Pip Benveniste. We catch up with him at Bristol's Arnolfini Art Gallery.
This is an exhibition of rugs that have been made in Kathmandu Valley, in Nepal. The designs are by the artist Pip Benveniste, British modernist artist.
Mother?
She's my late mother, yes. Before she died, she strongly encouraged me to do something with this project called Land Rugs, which was in its embryonic form. And she said, I've done a few designs, as you know. After I've gone, look through the art legacy that you're going to inherit. See if you can find some more designs and get them made up as rugs. It could be fun.
Well, they're wonderful. Can you tell us a bit more about your mother? Because she was a very interesting lady and she was part of the Cornwall art scene.
That's right. She was brought up in the bohemian lifestyle of the 1920s and 30s in Newlyn. And, of course, Newlyn is a crucible of the British modernist art movement. Indeed, her parents were artists. Her father, Alec Walker, worked with Tom Heron, father of Patrick Heron, to set up a really innovative art project called Crusade, which printed silk fabrics and silk garments to designs done by my grandfather, my mother's father. So she had art, actors, writers, conscientious objectors, anybody seeking a new world order was all part of my mother's bohemian childhood in Newlyn.
So you've been left with this legacy. Where are you taking it? Around the country?
I would love to. This is the first exhibition and it is to launch Land Rugs. And after that, we're going to have to see where it goes.
Why did you go to Bristol?
Bristol is our home. We've been here for about 18 years, my family, and we thought that the Arnolfini was the perfect place to have a launch of this new little business.
And are you involved with art yourself? Are you an artist?
No, I'm not. I was, in a sense, the one member of the family, the extended family, who never took up art. I worked in education for most of my life. I'm working in areas of human rights and social justice and school change in this country and overseas. And I retired from education about a year ago. And in that year, I've set up Land Rugs, getting the rugs made. I work with four weavers in Kathmandu. The rugs are all ethically produced. That means there's no child labour. There are no chemical acid dyes used in any of the wools. And all the rug weavers are registered with Goodweave, an international non-profit organisation trying to get children out of factories, carpet factories around the world, and get them into education. So Land Rugs decided to pay for its membership of Goodweave. So we're a registered licensee with Goodweave. We're giving extra money. 5% of all sales go to the education of children in Nepal.
That was Mark Vaughan talking about his mother, the artist Pip Benveniste. Before we play our next feature, we're going to play a track, and it's called Kissing in the Back Row by the Drifters. Something I think we should bring back.
Your mama says that through the week you can't go out with me. But when the weekend comes around, she knows where we will be.
Our next guest is Mike Tobin, who gives a fascinating insight to the early music scene. And he's interviewed by Kays Langan Dathy. Kays is one of our youngest presenters and is currently studying for his A-levels at Bristol Grammar School.
And here we have Mike Tobin. So how long have you been in the music business?
Longer than I care to admit. It started for me when I was a teenager in Bristol, way back in the 1950s. Really when the beginnings of modern pop music was happening with skiffle and rock and roll. And that was how it started. I was at a youth club in Westbury Village, Westbury-on-Trim, and we had a youth club leader who was very enlightened for the time, and he persuaded us to form a youth club skiffle group, and that's how it all started. So we learnt a few chords and off we went.
And I would imagine that you've seen quite a few greats in your time in music business.
Well, I've certainly seen many, many great acts right the way back to when I was just a fan and I saw the Beatles at Bath Pavilion in 1964, for instance. Then I was still amateur. I had proper jobs as well during the daytime. But our band was very popular in Bristol, so we often got the support slot when a major act would come into town. So we supported the Rolling Stones twice, once at the Corn Exchange, which is now St. Nicholas Market, and once at the Colston Hall. So that was amazing for a kid in late teens, early 20s, to have that experience was absolutely amazing.
And what would you say your role in the music business is?
Well, now it's changed dramatically. Very briefly, what happened was that I was singing with various bands in Bristol throughout the 60s. And then got involved in actually putting events and gigs on at various clubs and venues around the Bristol area. As a result of that, I got to know quite a lot of the agents and managers who were all based in London. And one of them invited me to go up and join his team in London because he needed an assistant and thought I was suitable for the job. So I left Bristol and moved up to London in 1970. And that was really my entry into the music business full-time then. That became my job, my career. And I worked in various offices with various agents, various managers over the next several years. And then also worked for Richard Branson, Virgin Records. I worked for RCA Records for 4 years. That was a very exciting time throughout the 70s. So I'd given up singing then. I was basically on the other side of the counter, if you like, doing the business side of it. Throughout that time, though, I always kept a watch on Bristol because it's my hometown. I love it. I'm passionate about Bristol music and Bristol bands. And there was one in particular that I went on to manage, a band called Stackridge, who was formed in 1969. And I'm glad to say it's still going strong to this very day and still making great music and producing great records. But during that time, obviously, you're working for major labels and so on, you do get to meet some and work with some very big stars. And I have some very fond memories, if you want to hear one or two of them.
Yes.
Okay, well, one I was very impressed with, and people will smile when I say this and wonder why, but I'll explain, was Dolly Parton. Now, Dolly was wonderful. She was just such a pleasure to work with. She was great fun. She was cooperative. And it was her first time in England, and I was on the tour with her throughout the time she was over here, organising her PR promotion. Another American act that I thought were absolutely wonderful was Hall & Oates, Darryl Hall and John Oates. Made some great records, and they were one of the best live bands that I ever saw.
And how would you say the music industry has changed over the course of you being in it?
Well, of course, technology now has changed with the internet and so on. That has changed the whole ball game incredibly, in many ways for the better, but in some ways for the detriment of the business, specifically because it's much more difficult for people to make money anymore, and that's particularly true of musicians, which is very sad. Musicians deserve to be paid as much as any other skilled trade, but they're expected to do stuff for nothing, which I think is outrageous, and I fight that as much as I can. But what's interesting is now, of course, with people youthful age, you know, you can make a great record in your bedroom using a computer and Pro Tools and you're away. And you can put that out on YouTube for the video and suddenly you've got tens of thousands of fans. The problem with it, though, is that, if you like, there's too much noise out there now because there's too much. Everybody can do it, therefore everybody's trying to do it, and obviously not all of it is very good. But how do you find the good stuff in amongst all the rubbish? That is the difficulty for music fans, but it's also the difficulty for people in the music business. Where do you find the next act?
So how do people in the music business generally find their next act?
Well, much the same way as it's always been. I mean, there's some aspects of the business haven't changed at all. It's become even more crucial now to be able to play well live, and so that's where they will go if they get a sniff that an act is good because they're being talked about on Twitter or on Facebook, or there is even a very good video. That still doesn't guarantee that that band can play live or make more good records, so they will go and find them and have a look. And it still works that people who have a reputation in the business, good managers, good agents, who over the years have been associated with very successful acts, will be approached, and they will also be always on the lookout for artists and new acts. So that aspect of it hasn't changed very much. But what can happen occasionally, as we know, is that, particularly if it's an extremely exciting and unusual video, that will go viral, and with no help from the music industry at all, that's the people voting, if you like, by flicking a switch or pressing a button. And that can produce amazing results, and there's been some huge success stories going down that road.
So what do you think are the best things about the new technology which is enchanting the music business?
I think, well, it works in two ways. I think certainly as far as the internet is concerned, as I've already said, that gives the opportunity for lots of people to have a go and sometimes with amazing results. The other end of the spectrum, with the very, very big acts and the huge festivals, the technology now for the stage lighting and for the sound is just absolutely extraordinary. And so it's almost impossible to have a bad sound or a show from that point of view. Still means the artist has got to better perform and play properly and sing properly, but a lot of that can be hidden, if you like, by the technology of the lighting, and so that's changed a lot.
And now back to Bristol. What do you think Bristol's role is in the music business?
Bristol has always been a hotbed of music. I mean, way back in the 50s, it was one of the main jazz cities in the UK, and just as with every other city, in the late 50s, early 60s, Bristol had something like 300, 350 active bands, all great bands, most of them amateur, very few of them ever made any record, but they were working almost every night of the week, because if you went to a dance, there was a live band. It was as simple as that. There was no DJ playing records, you know. So that was always strong. But for some mysterious reason, when, obviously Liverpool being the typical one, but when Liverpool happened, Manchester, Birmingham, Sheffield, all the other major cities in the UK, at some time or other, the record industry based in London would go to that city to find and sign new bands. It didn't happen to Bristol. And it's a puzzle. We've never understood that, because the talent was here. However, not too many years ago, of course, we had the Wild Bunch, which moved on and became Massive Attack. You had Porter's Head, you had Tricky, and so on and so on. Then suddenly everybody's looking at Bristol, and there's a Bristol sound. A little bit late in the day, but Bristol finally became a major force internationally, and still is regarded as such. That is good, because it's focused a lot more energy on the city, and now the music scene in Bristol is fantastic. It's better than it's ever been. There's more live bands, there's more live venues, and that's all to be encouraged. It's really good. All we've got to do is make sure people go out and support those bands.
So the future for Bristol looks bright.
It does. It's looking good. I'm thrilled to bits to be back here involved in it all again, because I'm finding it as exciting as it's ever been.
Thanks very much, Mike, for coming in and sharing your musical life with us.
That was Mike Tobin talking about the early music scene. To end the show, Tim Burrows is going to play and sing a number called Another Voice is Silent. Tim is a regular contributor to Backchat. As well as performing in venues around Bristol, he is often heard in the Tinner's Arms down in Zenor in Cornwall. So now over to Tim.
Another voice is silent. Another singer gone, and my words to fill up the silent night and take us through till dawn. Thank you. man who needed amphetamine to ease his inner pain, needed a great woman's love to make him whole again. Another voice is silent, another singer gone, and my words to take us through the night, take us through till dawn. So let us join our hearts to his, sing his last refrain. Let him know his songs live on. Now he is free from pain.
Tim Burrows playing one of his compositions, Another Voice is Silent. That's all from Backchat this week. Presenters were Lily Marion, John Peters Coleman, Danann McAleer, and Kays Langendathy. Features were by Anthea Page. Engineers were Adrian Petrowski and Zenos Barrett. The producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul, and from all the team here at Backchat, a very happy new year to you all. Goodbye.